Welcome to the Rutgers University Quarterly Business Outlook podcast, recorded April 26, 2011, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I'm your host, Steve Lubetkin. Welcome to the Rutgers Quarterly Business Outlook podcast for April 26th, 2011, the second quarter of 2011. We have two panelists on the program today, Dr. Herb Taylor, Vice President and Corporate Secretary at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, and Martin Bieber, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Kennedy Health System. Herb Taylor joined the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia in 1981 and in 1991 became the Philadelphia Fed's public affairs officer with responsibility for its external outreach, media relations, and public education programs. As corporate secretary, he's charged with administration of the Philadelphia Fed's board of directors and advisory councils. He's a member of the National Association of Business Economists and serves on the boards of Economics Pennsylvania, which supports economic and financial literacy in primary and secondary schools, the CFA Society of Philadelphia, and the Bond Club of Philadelphia. Martin Bieber joined Kennedy Health System in 2006 as Senior Vice President of Operations and was named Executive Vice President of the organization in 2008. Kennedy has three acute hospitals, a skilled nursing facility, and ambulatory facilities in Camden and Gloucester counties. Before joining Kennedy, Bieber worked for 14 years with Catholic Health Services of Long Island. There, he served as President and Chief Executive Officer of Mercy Medical Center and for 12 years at St. Francis Hospital, the Heart Center, Vice President and Chief Operating Officer. Martin Bieber is a certified public accountant and a member of numerous healthcare organizations, including the American College of Healthcare Executives. Currently, he's a member of the board of Bancroft NeuroHealth. At the lectern to open today's program is Steven Greenberg, a shareholder at Flaster Greenberg, our presenting sponsor.
Good morning. I'm Steve Greenberg of the law firm of Flaster Greenberg. I'm a shareholder and the chairman of our corporate and healthcare departments, which is why I'm offering introductory remarks this morning and introducing some of our folks up here. I want to welcome you to the Rutgers Camden Quarterly Business Outlook, which, as its name implies, is intended to be put on four times a year. But as those of you who registered for the January session know, that this is our first meeting of 2011, because unfortunately our January session was canceled as a result of the unfortunate hotel fire that they had here. But no one was injured, thankfully, and our panel members, or at least two of them, were able to make it back, and for that we are very thankful. Flaster Greenberg is a full-service law firm that has been a partner of Rutgers Camden and the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey for many years, putting on this program, because education and information to our clients and our community members is part of our core values. And in that regard, last month we also teamed with Rutgers to put on a New Jersey-Pennsylvania Sustainability Symposium, which was a free all-day seminar on alternative energy, and we were very pleased to bring you a panel of nationwide experts. It's perhaps one of the hottest topics at the present time, along with healthcare. We expect to continue to bring these kinds of top quality programs to the community and partner with Rutgers for a very long time. At this point, it is my pleasure to present the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey, Kathleen Davis.
Thanks, Steve, and good morning, everyone. Thank you all for coming out today. We're really pleased to once again offer such a distinguished panel for the Rutgers Quarterly Business Outlook, and including one of our board members, Marty Bieber from Kennedy, and of course, Dean Ganesh, who is the moderator, who is also a member of our board of directors. Just to take a moment to just reinforce that maintaining your membership in the chamber is more important than ever. And as we look at today's economic climate, having the opportunity to network with other high-level business people is a really important way to grow your business. And I think that we really stand out in terms of the quality and the quantity of events that we offer our members, networking opportunities that can give you the advantage over your competitors. And certainly programs like today's Rutgers Quarterly Business Outlook arm you with important information that can really help you shape your business strategy. So if you want an organization to introduce your products or services through, if you want to reinforce your company's brand awareness, and if you want to interact with a highly targeted business audience, you really need to belong to our chamber. Diana Meyer, who's our director of membership, is in the back there. If you're interested, make sure you talk to her. I just want to close my comments by thanking our longtime partners, Rutgers School of Business and Flaster Greenberg, for all of their support over many, many years in bringing this important event to you. And so at this time, I'm pleased to turn the program over to Dean Ganesh from the Rutgers School of Business, Camden. Please join me in a warm welcome for Dean Ganesh.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. It's a great day. It's a very nice day, bright. So I'm glad to see a good crowd here. I know we all missed the January edition of this Outlook, but I think we have a very good program here with two very distinguished guests with us. We have a bit of, I'm going to talk about how today's event is going to go through, but before I do that, I want to thank our partners, the law firm of Flaster Greenberg and the Chamber of Commerce, for their continued support of this program and a lot of other programs that Rutgers does with them. Thank you all so much. I also want to thank our production crew, Choose Crew, who are here filming this program for broadcast in Comcast. Thank you so much for a good job you do every time. Today we have two exceptionally top-notch experts in the area. You know, as Steve Greenberg mentioned, one of our guests was not able to make it due to some emergency situation, but that gives us some flex room here. We have Dr. Taylor, Herb Taylor, who's going to talk about the state of the economy. And today, when you look at it, it's a tale of two cities. It depends on which day you get up and which side of the bed you roll out, you know, where we are. And I'll talk a bit more on that. And then we have Mr. Bieber from the Kennedy Health Systems. That is another major area here today that we are looking at our healthcare system. And where are we headed? What are the pros and cons? How is it going to impact us? Given the fact that we have an hour, the entire program, and our cameraman has told me very clearly, keep it to an hour because they have to cut it at an hour, we want to provide you, the audience, with enough and more time to ask your questions of our guests. So I am thinking at this point we will have at least 20 to 25 minutes, definitely 20 minutes, for Q&A, and you can get all your questions answered of the economy and the health system and everything here. So before I go on, what I meant by the tale of two cities is absolutely true. Before this event, I was talking to Herb, and he was saying that nowadays you can't go to any event before reading the newspaper in the morning because things have changed, which is exactly right. And that's precisely what I did this morning. I woke up this morning and said, okay, what's happening to the economy today? And I was reading there, there's a lot of good news. The titles go saying that business spending is up by 8% this year, but still it's soft, okay? Then you look at GDP. The GDP is increasing, is expected to increase by around 3 to 3.2%. It's been increasing that way this last quarter. However, that is not enough. Why is it not enough? Unemployment is doing very good at 8.8%. But we need to have a 4% increase in GDP for one full year to see a 1% drop in unemployment. Okay, now we are tempered. Every good news is being tempered by something else. Inflation, completely under control, but watch out for the oil. You know, that if that keeps growing, it can, you know, cut off our growth. So it looks like somebody mentioned, I was reading somewhere, somebody mentioned that as the economy is taking off, we seem to have hit an air patch. We are still in the takeoff mode. So the good news is we are pointed in the right direction upwards, but we are in a air pocket, and I think our guests will help us clear how we get off the pocket. So before I turn it over to Dr. Taylor, I have two specific things that I would like Dr. Taylor to somehow, you know, integrate in this talk. One is oil. Will the rising oil price, can it really cause us to slip and go back? In other words, people talk about, no, the oil price has settled. You know, we are now in a phase where the peak, we have crested. You know, it's going to be at $105 per barrel, so not to worry. But then the news says if we go to $150 a barrel price, then we are back to where we were a couple of years ago. So I would like him to address that. But the second thing, which is a very interesting thing, several of us here, I'm sure definitely everybody from Rutgers, we haven't had raises for two, three years. There is a school of thought that actually we need to go thank our bosses for not giving us the raise, because by not giving us the raise, they have made sure the wage price spiral didn't lead us to a more serious inflationary situation. I'm sitting there going, okay, me not getting a raise is helping the economy? Great. That's my two cents to the economy. So you guys should feel good about that. If you haven't gotten a raise, you're doing your job for the economy, keeping the inflation low. So I would like Dr. Taylor to address that aspect also at some point in his speech. With that, I turn it over to Dr. Taylor.
Thank you very much, Dean. I appreciate that. And again, thank you for those pay freezes out there. That's really part of our strategy at the Federal Reserve. Good morning, everyone. It is my pleasure to be back with you this morning and to try to offer some perspective on where the economy is and where it's headed in light of all the issues that Dean Ganesh mentioned. Just to give you some broad perspective, thinking back, the most recent recession, what is now being called the Great Recession, was the longest and deepest recession in the history of the United States since the Second World War, since the Great Depression. It lasted for a year and a half, all of 2008, the first half of 2009. I think it's worthwhile to remember its darkest days in the fall of 2008, when the collapse at Lehman and crises at other financial institutions set off what I would say was a genuine modern-day financial panic in the United States. As a result of that severe financial crisis, we went into, as I said, the longest and deepest recession. Real GDP fell by 4 percentage points over the course of the recession. Payroll employment dropped by 6%. That amounts to nearly 9 million jobs. And the unemployment rate rose to 10%. A severe recession by any measure. The recession lasted for a year and a half, and now we've been in recovery mode for just over a year and a half. Began in the middle of 2009, so the second half of 2009, all of 2010, and now these first few months of 2011. And as I think we would all acknowledge, and as the Dean alluded, progress in this recovery has been relatively slow. It's been painstakingly slow. If you look at the research that's been done, not just into the history of business cycles in the United States, but business cycles around the world in developed economies and in developing economies in different time periods, way back to the 1800s even, researchers find that when a recession is precipitated by a financial crisis, such as the one we had here, recoveries take longer and are slower to unfold. It's just the way the world seems to work for financial matters to get back in order, not only in the financial sector, but among non-financial businesses and households to get their balance sheets in order and to get their credit restored and to be in a position to borrow and lend again just takes time. So I think there is an element of patience that we need to exercise in this economic recovery. However, again, I don't think we can deny the fact that the economy is at this stage of the game and in this stage of the recovery below where it needs to be as a long-run proposition. And as a matter of fact, we talk about economic growth, but if you look over the entire course of the cycle, where GDP was when the recession began at the end of 2007, where GDP was as of the last measurement we had, which was the fourth quarter of 2010, we're just now getting back to where we were in terms of the level of output, just getting back to where we were at the when the recession hit. So essentially, we've had zero growth over the last 3 years. And in an economy like ours, that is dynamic as ours, we're trying to hit a moving target here. So it's not a matter of just getting back to where we were. It's a matter of keeping up with the economy's potential for growth. Over time, we have the potential to grow our output at about 2% or a shade better year in and year out. So at this stage of the game, we're about 6 percentage points below where we could be in terms of output. And as you know, job creation has been slow. We lost almost 9 million jobs in the recession. So far, we've only gotten back a little over 1 million. It's been enough to move the unemployment rate, but only from 10% down to a shade below 9. So again, we need to be patient, but we also need to recognize that the economy is not where it ought to be. The good news, if there is some good news here, is that the economy is expected to continue to improve, continue to do better, and I'll say moderately better in 2011 than it did in 2010. So we'll be making progress. We'll be making progress on closing that gap between where we are and where we could be modestly over the course of 2011. Last year, real GDP growth was in the neighborhood of about 2.75%. The baseline forecast these days, I would say, is that growth in 2011 will be in the neighborhood of about 3.25% or so. So we'll make, again, a little bit better progress against closing that output gap. Employment is expected to pick up more markedly. We added about 100,000 jobs a month on average last year. We're expecting to add about 200,000 jobs a month on average this year. That would mean that the unemployment rate continues to decline, probably down to around 8% by the end of this year or early next. So we're moving in the right direction in terms of unemployment as well. There's plenty of slack in the economy, both in terms of labor markets and in terms of output markets. And so the underlying inflation trend remains relatively tame. Again, thanks to your pay freezes, unit labor costs, which are the most important component of costs, have been essentially flat since the recession began. And that means that the underlying or core rate of inflation is likely to remain relatively modest. Nonetheless, higher food prices and higher energy prices associated with the rising price of international price of oil have boosted inflation in recent months. We're probably going to see inflation in the 5% range for a little bit before it settles back down to about 2% or so as we move towards the end of the year. So a modest economic outlook in terms of growth, in terms of employment, and in terms of inflation over the course of 2011. I will say that while the forecast sounds like one for steady, sustainable growth, I have to acknowledge that quarter to quarter things seem to be a bit rougher. We're in for, to use your airline metaphor, something of some bumpy air for a while. In fact, in the current quarter, the quarter I should say that just ended, the first quarter of 2011, as I mentioned, rising food and energy prices created higher inflation than we would have expected just a few months prior. When the real GDP number is released for the first quarter, which will be later this week, the combination of the severe weather that we had in January and February, which kept people home from shopping and from getting to work, the earthquake and tsunami and the follow-on nuclear catastrophe in Japan has interrupted supply chains, as probably some of you have already experienced. Political turmoil in the Middle East and North Africa has raised the level of anxiety and perhaps more directly raised the price of oil, and obviously moved gasoline prices up considerably in recent months, $4 or $5 a gallon gasoline, pretty steep price. To respond to your question, Dean, I think the outlook for modest economic growth is predicated on the idea that we have seen the spike in oil prices that we are going to see. We've moved from, I'll call it the range of $80 a barrel or so, up to over $100 a barrel, about $110.
And I think most forecasters are looking for not much change in that price over the forecast horizon. If oil prices bump up, I think they slow economic growth, they shave something off that 3.25% growth, but they don't undo the economic recovery. They're just another headwind that keeps the recovery from picking up more speed than it otherwise would. If political situation stabilizes and oil prices drop, again, I think we get something of a tailwind that helps the economic growth rate pick up a shade, perhaps from where we see it right now. So I think it's a moderating factor in the outlook, not a driving factor in whether or not the recovery continues. The cross currents we've already seen in the first quarter of the year are likely to continue through the year. This is a year in which it seems already the unanticipated continues to happen. The session gets canceled because there's a fire in the lobby, or a speaker gets called away unexpectedly. One thing that I notice is we're becoming a lot more flexible. You know what I mean? So we didn't have it in January, we'll have it in April. We don't have a third speaker, so we'll talk more.
Slowly,
right. Great. And more chance to talk about the economy and the Fed. Nothing says it's going to be a great day like a conversation about the Fed at 8 o'clock in the morning. I think among the cross currents that we're likely to see throughout this year, and we've already seen them, of course, we're likely to see throughout the year, are the cross currents created by government policy itself. On the fiscal policy side, there are a number of cross currents. Think back to the depth of the recession in late 2008, early 2009. Congress and the President acting to pass the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. The impact of that stimulus package is now beginning to wear off. On the other hand, the stimulus from the, I had to write it down, Tax Relief, Unemployment Insurance Reauthorization and Job Creation Act of 2010, the set of tax cuts and transfer payments that the lame duck Congress and the President passed at the end of 2010, is just kicking in. So we have one stimulus package waning and another one waxing. And of course, we still have Congress and the President discussing what kinds of spending cuts ought to be made in 2011 and fiscal 2012. And I think, meanwhile, aside from the cross currents created by actual taxing and actual spending patterns, there's the uncertainty surrounding how the government is going to manage its debt position over the longer haul. What sectors are going to be affected by the changes in spending and taxation that will ultimately come out of the negotiations? I think this gives everybody a reason to be a little bit cautious, stand a little bit on the sidelines, and so the uncertainty itself takes something of the momentum out of the economic expansion. Well, on the monetary policy side, as you know, the Federal Reserve, again, during the depth of the financial crisis, as well as the early stages of the recession, pumped in an unprecedented level of liquidity into the banking system and into the financial system at large. We took the target federal funds rate down to the lowest level ever. We're basically targeting a funds rate between 0 and 25 basis points at this point. We purchased nearly $2 trillion in U.S. government securities and, in an unprecedented move, in agency-guaranteed mortgage-backed securities. And we pumped over $1 trillion into the reserve position of the commercial banking system. So we've added unprecedented levels of liquidity, taken interest rates to unprecedented lows. Now, as the recovery begins to gain some momentum, the Fed has to think about its so-called exit strategy, its strategies for restoring its balance sheet to a more normal form and restoring interest rates to more normal levels, so as to contain inflation in the long run while not disrupting the recovery of the economy in the short run. I think we can do it. We have the tools to do it. We have the political will to do it. But I won't deny that a move of that magnitude over a reasonable period of time is likely to leave us with a few anxious moments over the next year or so. Despite all the cross currents, including those on the policy side, I think that the outlook for modest economic growth is a reasonable one because it's built on the notion that a self-sustaining economic expansion is now underway. For several years, we saw more spending. What we're now seeing is that spending is generating more jobs, which is generating more income, which is generating more spending, which will generate more jobs, and so the virtuous cycle continues. If we look at where that the strength of that cycle will come over the course of the next year or two, in principle, as we've talked about many times at this forum, there are four sources of demand growth in the economy. Consumers can spend more on the goods and services that they buy. Businesses can spend more building inventories and, more importantly, investing in new plant and equipment, computer software, making those kinds of business-fixed investment decisions. We could see the government make stronger purchases of goods and services at the federal, state, or local level. And in principle, we could see demand growth as a result of an expanding trade sector over the course of the next year or so. That's in principle. In practice, I think over the course of this cycle, at least over the next couple of years, what we're likely to see is that the engines of growth are essentially the all-important consumer and the follow-on spending by non-financial businesses. On the consumer side, I don't think we have to think very hard to remember the bursting of the housing bubble, the financial crisis, the recession, and what they did to us as consumers. They decimated household balance sheets. They exposed some segments of the consumer population as over-leveraged. They cost many people their jobs. They raised the prospect of job loss, even for those who didn't lose their jobs. And in response, people cut back their spending. They prudently spent less and saved more. The savings rate rose. I think what we're seeing now is people's balance sheets come into a slightly stronger position, and as employment prospects improve, people are gradually beginning to spend more of their income. It's not necessarily that their savings rate will drop, but as their incomes rise, they will spend a good portion of that increase in income. And we're seeing it particularly in the expenditures consumers are making on durable goods. For example, before the recession, in the United States, we sold about 16 or 17 million new cars and trucks every year. At the depth of a recession, we cut that by a third. We were down to about 10 million units. The outlook for this year is we get half of that back. We're back to about 13 million units. So again, that gradual restoration of consumer spending, particularly among durables, as the expansion unfolds. The housing market, that particular segment of consumer spending, unfortunately, is likely to see a recovery that's slower to unfold than consumer spending more broadly. There are still too many foreclosures. There are still too many unsold homes on the market. There are still too many homes waiting to come onto the market as conditions improve for the housing market to generate a lot of new construction or even some stability in prices. Prices are likely to decline in order to clear the marketplace for the next year or so. Again, just to put it in perspective, before the recession began, at the height of the bubble, we were building over 2 million housing units a year in an economy that probably could sustain about 1.5 million units a year, given the demographics of our population. So we were way overbuilding during the course of the bubble. As a result of the bursting of the bubble, we're now at a trough. We're producing about 500,000 units at an annual rate. So think of that as just a third of what our long-run need will be. And the expectation is, again, we get some of that back in 2011 and 2012, but we're still in the neighborhood of 750 or 800,000 units, only about halfway back to our long-run trend. So that process is likely to be relatively slow to unfold. On the business side, that second building block of the economic expansion, again, thinking back to the depth of the recession, firms responded very quickly to the collapse in demand by slashing not only payrolls and not only production, but also by liquidating their inventories, maintaining very low inventories, and canceling just about every investment project that they had on the table. Since the recovery has begun, we've seen the benefits, if you will, in the recovery phase of the severe actions taken during the recession. Firms have, over the course of the recovery thus far, have been anxious to rebuild inventories, having sold down to the bare bones, down to the shelves, anxious to rebuild inventories to meet growing demand. They had, as I said, canceled investment projects. They've been relatively quick to restart those projects, particularly in the areas of purchasing equipment and software, because it keeps those unit production costs low by creating greater efficiency. And because having cut spending so dramatically, there's a lot of worn out and obsolete equipment to be replaced. What we're likely to see going forward is continued strength in business investment spending, driven essentially by those considerations of efficiency and obsolescence, but also considerations of growing demand and the need to expand capacity. As I said, there's a certain sluggishness on the housing side and the construction side for consumers. There's likely to be a continued sluggishness in firms' investment in new structures as we move through 2011 and 2012. While it may make sense to buy new equipment and add new software, again, there are just too many vacant office spaces, too many quieted production facilities, too much vacant retail space for there to be a great deal of construction in the near term. That's probably going to take a little bit of a while to bring back online, and perhaps will not come until early 2012. So, again, a modest economic outlook driven by modest growth in the two building blocks for demand growth, households and businesses. The other two sectors that I mentioned, the government and the trade sector, are not likely to contribute a great deal to growth in the aggregate in 2011 and 2012. Obviously enough, purchases at the federal level, at the state level, at the local level are all being hamstrung by budget considerations. Internationally, there is a lot of action these days all around the globe, as in some cases some unbelievable turns of events. I already mentioned the natural disaster in Japan. There are inflationary pressures and a surprising change in foreign exchange strategy by the government of China. There are political developments in the Middle East and in North Africa that are disrupting the sources of energy. And there's a sovereign debt crisis in Europe that has yet to be resolved. But I think when it comes to thinking about how our foreign trade is going to affect overall economic performance in the U.S. over the next year or so, we're looking at a small positive contribution built on some basics. The first is that the pace of global growth continues to be relatively strong. When you combine growth not only in developed countries, but also in the developing countries. And that means that there's a relatively strong growth in the demand for U.S. exports. So that's a plus. On the other hand, as I said, the pace of growth in the U.S. is likely to be sustained or maybe even pick up a bit. And when our economy grows, our demand for imports grows as well. And so we'll have something of a match of import growth with export growth. So there'll be something of a wash in terms of the overall demand for goods and services from our trade sector. I think the balance will tip slightly in favor of improving our trade balance simply because the dollar has resumed its slide. If you look back at the history of the value of the dollar over the last decade, the decade of the 2000s, the wide trade deficits of the late 1990s had put downward pressure on the dollar through most of the decade. There was a pickup in strength in the dollar during the financial crisis because the dollar is viewed as one of those currencies that's a safe harbor. But as you know, the dollar's been sliding again in recent months and weeks, and that's likely to make us somewhat more competitive on the international stage. So there might be some small positive contribution from the trade sector. In short, just to wrap up, I think we're looking at an economy in 2011 that will be moderately stronger than the one in 2010. It will be built on the fundamental building blocks of an acceleration in consumer spending and continued expansion of business investment spending. The best bet is probably for real growth in the neighborhood of about 3.25% above the long-run trend and enough to bring output closer to alignment with our potential output, generating enough new jobs to bring the unemployment rate down into the 8.5% to 8% range over the next year or two. And despite a bump up in inflation in the near term, we should be in an environment where inflation settles back down to about 2% or so by year end. I'll say that's the best bet, but there are plenty of cross currents out there at this point. So while it's the best bet, it's certainly not a sure bet. Just in keeping with the Dean's reference to air traffic, I think it's a year to keep your seatbelt fastened. While we look for a higher altitude and some smoother air. So, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for an extraordinarily insightful presentation of, you know, what is traditionally a very complex topic, but more so today because of the dynamic moving nature. Thank you so much, Dr. Taylor. Now it's my pleasure to introduce and turn the floor to Mr. Martin Bieber, President and CEO of Kennedy Health System, who will present his view of the state of the healthcare industry and what it means to us.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, it's interesting. I had my first healthcare job in 1980. I worked as a young man for Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City. And the chief financial officer took me into his office and said, "You're coming into healthcare at a very interesting time. It's very contentious, and it'll never be more exciting than this. Talk about air traffic control and the need to have your seatbelt fastened, because the world has changed many times since then." I also remember there was a television show at the time, and you may remember St. Elsewhere. And there was a doctor, Dr. Westfall, who was the chief medical officer, and I never forget him, because he was constantly walking through the halls with this big computer printout, and he was saying to everyone, "I'm going to look at the DRGs." I never in my life met a doctor who was interested in healthcare finance or how the system was paid for until now. The economy and the state of our system really has changed. You know, it's interesting when you talk about what constitutes healthcare, it's made up of a lot of pieces. People look at doctors, at hospitals and acute care providers, but it's a whole continuum to include nursing homes. It includes insurers, and it includes the government, because we're all part of the system together. Dr. Taylor's presentation was very instructive when he talks about the unemployment rate and the amount of unemployment and jobs coming back, because the nature of the healthcare industry really does rest and ride on government and how government deals with these issues. In the area of unemployment, what happens is people become unemployed, they have health benefits, and they can continue their health benefits through COBRA and COBRA benefits. But COBRA benefits are short-lived and they expire. So as people start getting, continue with their unemployment beyond the expiration of their COBRA benefit, all of a sudden they're showing up in our emergency rooms because their doctors won't take them anymore because they don't have the ability to pay for their care, which increases the cost of care. We've actually seen a good couple of percentage points increases in our ERs in the region here of indigent and bad debt patients because they don't have the ability to pay. It's also interesting to note in the state of New Jersey, there is no public hospital system. You may not notice, I really don't have an accent, but I'm a transplanted New Yorker. In New York, there is a very robust public hospital system, so the nature of healthcare really varies from state to state. And what we see here, Kennedy actually gives out $30 million a year of free healthcare. And when I say $30 million, I don't mean our charges, I mean our cost, with a bad debt charity care system in the state. So the systems here lag the ability to pay for it or have the ability to provide us the revenue streams to cover the cost of our care. The other things that we've observed here in the market is that, frankly, the indigent population is growing. We're also finding that doctors are working a lot harder to make less. I don't know if you've ever focused on it, but the average doctor out there in the marketplace today is a small individual entrepreneur unless they're part of a large group. What I've learned is that many of our doctors are working almost twice as hard to bring home 40% less. The days of going past hospital doctors' parking lots and seeing high-end cars are gone. You're seeing Toyotas, you're seeing Volkswagens, you're seeing Nissans. You're not seeing the Mercedes, the Cadillacs, as I used to look at them, you know, in the lots today, which has caused a lot of issues because it really gets into the supply of doctors in the marketplace today. Healthcare reform, and the question is, what is healthcare reform and what will it be, subject to the whims of Congress in the future, doesn't address a number of issues that we need in this country. Healthcare reform, what it did do in the initial legislation that was passed, creates more covered lives, which lives will be covered in the year 2014. And in fact, that's really good news. But here's what it doesn't do. It doesn't increase the supply of physicians who are going to care for those lives. In fact, according to the Institute of Medicine, somewhere in the year 2020, we're going to have somewhere between depending on who you read, between 75,000 and 200,000 doctors less in primary care in the marketplace today than to take care of these additional lives. If you think of it, there are about 32 million uncovered lives today that will be covered in the year 2014. So the question is, where do these people go for their care? And the payment mechanism that has been defined to deal with it and accommodate it has yet to be identified. As it stands today, I'd ask you the question, when you are not feeling well, and it's about 6 in the evening, and you call your doctor's office, what do you get when you call your doctor's office? Do you get a receptionist? Okay, you get a tape. The tape basically says, if you're not feeling well, the office is presently closed. If you're not feeling well, call 911 or go to your nearest ER. Well, in effect, hospital ERs have become the caretakers of patients after normal business hours. So where are people going? They're going for a level of care that by law in the state of New Jersey and in most states has to be at a much higher level than if you went to your doctor's office. And in effect, I would submit that some 30% of the visits that come to emergency rooms, certainly in this state, in fact the region, probably could very easily be treated in the doctor's office. So the issues of healthcare reform have not begun to address that, including the supply of physicians. And if we want to even look at the supply of physicians, and I think it's really terrific, we have now two medical schools here in South Jersey, the new coming Rowan Cooper Medical School and Kennedy's alignment with UMDNJ School of Osteopathic Medicine. And we're producing doctors in this marketplace today. The federal government actually did not increase the accessibility or availability of new graduate medical education slots to train new doctors to be available in the market. I'll also let you know, if you haven't read it, according to the Institute of Medicine, one out of every three practicing physicians today is over the age of 55. So think of what that does for the future of the supply of physicians who are going to take care of the market. The other situation that affects also is the cost of medical education today is rather enormous. So when you think about young people going to medical school who are going to invest, it could be upwards of $150,000 to $200,000 for their medical education, by the time they're graduating, will be lucky to get their first job if they're going to be in a general medical specialty, $125,000. Now, you could say that's a lot of money. But the average doctor who graduates graduate medical education that starts practice is 29 to 30 years of age, as compared to most of us who come out of college at age 21, 22, and into the workforce. So while they're starting to make more money, their productive life in medicine is significantly shorter. I will also tell you that somebody goes into a more advanced specialty, cardiology, nephrology, neurosurgery, those people typically don't enter practice well into their 30s, if not close to 40 years of age. So the pool of talent that we need to have available to meet the needs in the system, and this is around the country, is rather significant. And that question has not been resolved by healthcare reform. Because the nature of medical education in this country, believe it or not, it goes back to its roots from the GI Bill post-World War II. Prior to World War II, most of your doctors out there were your, quote, Marcus Welbys. They were your family practitioners working in the marketplace today. After World War II, you had the GIs coming home and went back to medical school. And they were very, very plentiful. In fact, a lot of the people who today are practicing are well into their retirement ages come out of that era, World War II, Korean War conflict, and what have you. What happened in 1965 with the passage of Medicare, because Medicare has only been created since 1965, graduate medical education reimbursement was created as the vehicle to fuel new doctors and teach them to work in various different specialties. And in doing so, they actually work through hospitals to get their specialty training in hospitals. So that's the mechanism that exists today, and that's where the shortfall or the shortage exists. The other interesting thing and the interesting phenomenon, and I hear this from doctors all the time, and I'm talking a little bit about doctors because that's the personal side of what we do, is that I know a lot of doctors in this market. I know a lot of doctors from my old market, and they all tell me the same thing. When you go into their office as a patient, they know in about 30 seconds what's wrong with you and what they're going to do for you. But a lot of the costs that they incur and what they prescribe for you, And what they do for you is to protect themselves from potential exposure to litigation, to make sure their documentation is in order. They're going to order that extra MRI. They're going to order those extra lab tests. But in effect, they're going to give you that antibiotic because they know you have an infection, or they're going to give you something to deal with your symptoms. So the nature of what medicine is at a very interesting crossroads, because the system of rewards doesn't meet the needs of the patient and the needs of the providers to deliver the care that needs to be delivered. The other interesting thing that's a problem with our system, it's great to talk about the problems, isn't it? Is that the system today rewards episodes of care. They reward the visit to the doctor. They don't have the rewards tied to what I'll call longitudinal treatment, which is treat the disease, not the person. So it could be, right now today, it's in a doctor's best interest to have that patient come back again and again and again. And I'm not saying doctors are gaming the system. Their offices are busier than busy. There are doctors who aren't taking appointments for weeks, if not months out. And you probably know that when you as a patient make an appointment. But the nature of the system doesn't have us doing disease management. And the system of rewards for hospitals on the acute care side versus doctors has not been synchronized yet. So in effect, there is no solution that's been identified for that. So we and our respective organizations are trying to come up with our own solutions to deal with that. And I'll talk about that in a minute. What we're also finding is that, especially, and I'll talk a little bit about our region in this particular market, a lot of people in this market like to go across the river into Philadelphia for their health care. And what I find fascinating, I'll say again, being a former New Yorker, I worked in a hospital in Long Island for quite a while. We saw that people were migrating off Long Island into New York City for their acute care needs. And we changed that, and we changed it by doing a couple of things, and we're applying those principles here, and we're finding that it's starting to work. And an interesting statistic came my way. In the year 2009, which is the last year I looked at it, 19,478 residents of Camden and Gloucester counties were admitted to Philadelphia hospitals for a variety of medical diagnostic categories that could be treated in hospitals here in South Jersey. But they chose to go across the river. And to me, the other part of the answer or the issue that has to be dealt with comes down to the quality of care or perceived quality of care in the local marketplace today. And to me, that's also opportunity for us if we work more intelligently together here on the side of the river. And it's kind of interesting because I've been with Kennedy now 5 years, and in my time with Kennedy, we've put a huge investment in quality care at the bedside, quality of care with our doctors, providing our doctors with outcomes data that really hasn't been available to be seen here in this market before. And speaking again from where I used to be, in the state of New York was very, very transparent with their data. We're finding by showing doctors their outcomes data, they're improving their outcomes. We've also found by investing in bedside care, we could substantially improve the care at the bedside. So for the care that we measure, we found that we've virtually eradicated hospital-acquired pneumonias or ventilator-associated pneumonias. Is that a big deal? Yeah, it is a big deal, because hospitals in the future will not be paid for conditions that are incurred in the hospital. And it's something that has to be done, and it's a hospital's responsibility to assure a safe and better than expected outcome to each and every patient. And by making these investments, we're finding we're getting better outcomes. We've reduced substantially to close to zero bloodstream infections, and we're happy to boast that our surgical complication and infection prevention rate is now one of the best of the state of New Jersey. Well, how does this translate into the economy? Well, I could say, again, this may sound like a Kennedy commercial. We're pleased that we're the only place in the region that the Rothman Institute has chose to work in this region in New Jersey. Why? Because the qualities have gone up. Why would Rothman work at Kennedy? Well, the opportunity is to do the business in the region or potentially lose it, because it may not follow across the river if we provide a competitive resource to them. We're seeing that in a variety of different areas. We're now going down the same path with neurosurgery. We're having the Jefferson Neurosurgery Department is now credentialed at Kennedy and will be doing neurosurgery at Kennedy. Why? It's an economic driver. We've got 150,000 visits to our emergency room. Last year, we generated over 600 neurosurgical cases out of our ER. The value of a neurosurgical case to a doctor or a hospital that receives them is huge. And if you look, again, in 2009, south of Route 195 from the river to the ocean, almost 30,000 patients or residents were admitted to hospitals for neurological diagnostic intervention. About 9,000 of those cases went into Philadelphia last year. Some of them stayed here. We see Capital Health up north. So the question is, do people want to go all the way up north to Trenton? Do they want to go across the river to Philadelphia? How do these competitive forces come together? The economic driver, because a lot of hospitals have paid doctors for directorships in order to get them to work there, but how much can a directorship really be worth versus the value of being in a market and securing a couple of thousand patient referrals that you otherwise wouldn't make? So the nature of what becomes economic alignment between good quality doctors and providing comes down to also providing an excellent quality environment where they can operate and actually see great outcomes. So in effect, the relationship with us, with Rothman, has been phenomenal because they like what they're seeing. The attraction for Jefferson University neurologists and neurosurgeons has been remarkable because they like what they're seeing. And for us, the partnership with an Abramson Cancer Center is our outcomes in cancer are now being overseen by their tumor board and their cancer committee, and it's consistent with the outcomes that they want to see. So where I'm going with this, it all comes down to a combination of what I think is three things in the marketplace that will help us secure the health of the market, because I don't see the government responding, and I don't see the insurance companies responding. And that gets down to tying some level of economic linkage where we're permitted to link. If you keep in mind, insurance companies are allowed to link because under the ERISA laws, they're allowed to talk to each other. I can't talk to my competitor at Virtua, my competitor at Lourdes, or my competitor at Cooper, because that would be antitrust violation. Insurance companies can because they have those protections. Insurance companies, by the way, are not subject to lawsuits for denying care because of their denial processes, because they're also protected under the same ERISA laws. They can't be held accountable for denying care. But we as subscribers go into that kind of a program. So that's kind of the situation we've created that really does dictate the economics of what's going on in the market. And it's kind of interesting because my son-in-law approached me not too long ago to say, you know, I just noticed, you know, we went to a doctor and my copay has gone up and I really didn't know it. So we're seeing another class now of economic hardship for the patients in the market, that employers are adjusting their insurance and medical benefits for their covered lives. That's increasing the amount of copays and deductibles for the patients. And it's just creating another challenge for the healthcare system, because doctors and hospitals must go after literally every dime that's due them in order to cover their cost. So we have a lot of these issues that are all affecting the industry. I sit here as a person who is overseeing a modest-sized healthcare system, and the question is, what are our options and what is it that we can do to handle this? Well, we speak to third-party payers and we speak to the insurance companies. And one of their biggest issues in terms of containing costs, because when I look at my financial statements, our costs really aren't going up in these big numbers that you see in the literature. But the real cost of the system is in more utilization of more expensive services, because you don't see availability of lower cost alternatives for healthcare because doctors' offices are closing earlier. There's no incentive for them to stay open. And the issue comes really down to utilization management in the case of the third-party payers, which is their biggest problem. And what does utilization management mean? Think about it. You're a patient. You have an injury. You get your third-party insurer gives you 12 physical therapy visits to help you deal with your issue. You know what? You're going to use every one of those 12 visits, whether you need them or not. So the question is, how do you control that utilization? And that's a big problem of the third-party payers. You know, you talk about the issue of what is accountable health care and where is our accountable care organizations going. I think you've all heard the term accountable care organization, but I'm sure a lot of you don't really know what that is. Technically, accountable care organization is an organization that covers a minimum of 5,000 covered Medicare lives where you're taking risk for their care. But it hasn't been defined a lot more finely than that. What hospitals are doing is they're increasing the ranks of their aligned physicians so they could start to cover lives, but they're increasing those ranks differently. In this particular market, some institutions are employing doctors. In others, they are acquiring practices and paying equity for practices. But there are different forms of alignment that are happening. In our situation at Kennedy, we're actually looking to create a network whereby we can capture our patients as far upstream as possible before an illness becomes acute. Because we know in 2 years from now, we're not going to be paid for that patient when they come to our emergency room. So do we want to bite the bullet now, or do we want to wait until that point that somebody pulls a trigger and the whole system changes? It's also interesting when you look at the state of Massachusetts that looks at itself as reasonably progressive. In the state of Massachusetts, legislation was enacted about 2 years ago that eliminated the ability of third-party payers to control rates and rate setting, because what they did is all third-party payers have to basically pay the same under the same system and all lives are covered. The bad news is their cost of health care has gone up, exploded, because they can't contain that utilization problem. So that's not a fitting solution, and it's the concern of third-party payers here in this state that if the system and we can't collaboratively get our arms around it, the federal government's going to make that decision for all of us. And then the question is, what do we have by way of a healthcare system? So I've done, I think, a pretty interesting job of laying out a whole bunch of problems out there. But there are, I believe there are solutions, and they're tied to a number of basic principles. The principles we've adopted as a three-legged stool, which is an economic form of alignment, providing first-rate quality services, and creating more points of access for patients when patients need that access, because that's what they need. So in our case, is we've actually put out physician practices in the community, and we're keeping them open later at night. Not urgent care centers, but we're keeping them open when patients want them. I'm sure you've all seen the Kennedy ads for the nurse navigators, haven't you? Okay, those aren't customer services people, those are nurses. That's a clinical program, those are not clerks receiving calls. They're out there to make sure that when a patient leaves our ER, they're plugged into a doctor and they can follow up their care and have a continuity of care. We also are rolling that out actually in a couple of weeks for telephone access. And what's pretty interesting is our competitors now, we have patients in our competitors' hospitals who are calling out navigators to say, can you help me out, which is a pretty cool thing. But the reality is our strategy is tied to treating patients further upstream before their illness becomes acute, where we could treat them more simply in the office because that's where we need to be. So we're creating more points of access, later hours, tied to better quality, because every doctor who participates with Kennedy is we're monitoring and measuring their quality outcomes, infection rates, returns to the OR, patient satisfaction, we're measuring it all. And their ability to participate is based on their ability to deliver service to that level. And so those are the three principles. I think by staying true to those principles, our system of healthcare is evolving to that point. But unlike, I'll leave you with one last point. Unlike just about every other country in the world, we don't have a Ministry of Health. There is not one point in the government that determines how healthcare is going. I think when President Obama proposed healthcare reform legislation for the first time, you know, you heard the story about death squads, but the reality is healthcare is rationed in every other country in the world. It's not rationed here. And that gets into utilization management. So somewhere inherent in there is where these solutions are going to have to be for us to get our system on a steady course. And then maybe we'll be able to unbuckle our seatbelt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bieber. Thank you very much for an insightful presentation.
That will conclude this edition of the Rutgers University Quarterly Business Outlook podcast. We hope you enjoyed the program. For more information on upcoming programs from Rutgers University School of Business at Camden, please visit the Rutgers website at camden-sbc.rutgers.edu. For more information on Lubetkin Communications, our public relations and podcasting services, please visit our website, www.lubetkin.net. Again, if you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, please email us at steve@lubetkin.net. And if you send us an audio comment, we'll consider using it in a future program. Special thanks to Samantha Collier and Michael Sapanik of Rutgers University for their assistance in the production of these programs. And we do produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts, LLC, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey, and Flaster Greenberg, our presenting sponsor, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.